All right, I'm going to hit record on my Audacity.
Record, 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 record. Checking.
Welcome to that spiritual, actual, factual answers to questions he asking. You find them inside you, recite you, reciting the records of cash. We laughing, we drafting the passion through varying. It's time for that comedy, dramedy, all of the fanciest, catchiest acronyms. Listeners, listen, we traveling. Consciousness is always unraveling. The reading you're having is mapping you back to your natural habitat. Abracadabra, it's magic, let's pass it. To top it off, the host are the classiest. Now, what were you asking for? All of the answers, what? All the answers.
Which is frustrating. Okay.
Why? Where are you?
This fan, it's always my problem. Every time we record, I'm sweating by the end because the window's right here. And if I close it, it gets hot for a different reason that I don't understand. And so I don't know.
It's so cold where we are right now.
I don't know what to say.
I don't understand. Are you having perimenopause or premenopausal hot flashes?
I mean, maybe. But it's also like right now warm in here. And if I turn the fan on, not warm. So that seems like.
You must have central heating at the place you live. So the heat is on. The heat's not on?
No.
It is so cold everywhere right now.
Yeah, but we're on the third floor. We have no cold. If the windows were open, it would be freezing in here.
Interesting.
But let's see. I can't open the windows because then there's background noise. And then I can't turn the fan on because then there's background noise.
Yeah. Well, maybe if you start to get sweaty, turn on the fan for a few minutes and then turn it back off.
That's what I end up doing every time. Here's a random question. Do you happen to know if I can charge sales tax for a service?
I have no idea.
Didn't think so.
Probably.
It's.
I mean, there's tax on like restaurant food.
Right. This one real.
And I get taxed when they send a person out to like my house to do a thing.
Right. Right?
I mean, there's tax on that. Yeah, I think maybe you're supposed to. I don't know.
This realtor who's maybe finally hiring me to do a staging job is telling me, I've never had a stager charge tax before. And also, don't you not charge tax when you're a service in the state of California? And I'm like,
I don't know.
I don't know. So like we built the taxes in because the like program we have that automatically builds our invoices builds it in, and we looked into it. So anyway, now my assistant is like hustling, running around to try to figure out if we need to remove our tax charges.
It's probably different for different states and different licensing, so I have no idea.
And different products, like different things you're selling, like an object. Hold on 1 second. This, like, if you're selling an object or a product. You definitely do. It's just that she says with services you don't. And I'm like, realtors will say any fucking thing to save money. They really will. They're turning out to be.
You should probably call your little sort of, didn't you meet some stagers who are like your mentors a little bit?
Yep.
I feel like that's a phone call.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Yeah. Here's how I know I'm pretty good.
Okay.
And that's like the spiritual lesson here is we have mice again and we're dealing with it.
Oh, gosh.
But in the past, obviously, anything that goes wrong with the house, I feel immediately panicky responsible for.
Right.
And I'm a terrible landlord and they're miserable and they're freaking out and I have to make their life perfect. That's my job. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Right? All those thoughts run through my head. The moment something goes slightly wrong, it's not happening. It's like, no. Yeah, I'll call the guy. Oh, he can't come out right away. I'll go buy some mouse traps.
That's cool.
And I'm just like taking care of it. And guess what? Their response is the same. Oh, thank you. That's it. That's like.
Right. Right. Right.
But when I'm avoidant.
Good for you.
When I'm avoidant because I'm afraid, then they get more panicky. Because they can tell that I'm not taking care of it.
1,000%.
So skip the fucking first step and go right to just taking care of shit.
That's what I was talking about last week on here when I was going through that weird list of like, well, if this happens, then you just face it and you tell the person the truth and then you handle that. Like, it's all the avoidant behaviors that always wind us up in trouble.
I learned that lesson so many times and I'll still learn it.
Yeah.
I think I've told this before, but like when I was, I learned this lesson from my boss when I was working at a theater 100 years ago. And I have an issue, just real quick, because I've said it before, I have an issue with dread. So I don't do something because I'm dreading the...
You don't have... Please don't rush. The rushing...
Yeah. No, go, but I want to do it fast.
It makes me so nervous.
Oh, well, that's something you have to work on.
No, it isn't.
Wouldn't that be funny if literally anything anybody ever reacted to was only... Nope. Sorry, that's a you thing.
Uh-huh.
Nope. Anyway, point being, I deal with dread a lot, and it's the same thing as with the mouse problem. Dread about how someone's going to react, how I'm going to say it, how it's going to go. I'm still going to have to do it.
Exactly.
So why not just do it?
Exactly.
And the dread would make me put it off, which just meant I was experiencing dread for longer.
Right.
And I have just such a very specific memory of I had gone up and it was a casting thing, and the artistic director was like, "Oh, have you talked to Dan yet?" And I was like, "Oh, I haven't gotten a hold of him," which was a fibby, like, because I'd reached out in the least confrontative way. Like,
right,
I'd reached out via an email once, you know, rather than all the avenues. And he literally, while talking to me, he happened to know this person's phone number. He was like, "Oh, well," and he's like, as he's narrating, he picks up the phone and he's dialing it. He wasn't being a jerk to me. He was just like, "Oh, well, we should find that out. Hey, Dan, did you get that thing? And are you going to be able to make it?" Great. And he was like, the answer was, it was done before he was even done asking me whether it was done.
Totally.
And that's how he would deal with things.
Well, but here's the thing too, you got to remember, you have open solar plexus, and open solar plexus people have, the whole not self theme of the open solar plexus is conflict avoidance. And so then if you remember, the freedom of the open solar plexus is I'm free to be emotionally neutral and tell the truth, which is it is the opposite of the not self, which makes you confront the not self, which is scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that make sense? So you're not crazy. It's like built into your design.
Yeah.
It's almost like I could have predicted this would happen that this would be a consistent thing you're running into,
yeah,
because it's the not self of the open. Like in my case with definition in the solar plexus, it's not like I'm so comfortable with confrontation all the time either, but it'll be less of a consistent theme once I learn the lesson of just be direct, just ask the questions. It's like going to be, the not self doesn't have a hold of me so strong there. It has a hold of me other places.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's just kind of cool to hear you say that, because I'm like, oh, look at that. Human design works.
It's real and true.
I had another thing today, and then I want to hear more about you, where I left Rami a message saying, I had this insight about people with open throat. You don't have that, right? You don't have open throat, right?
It's one of my few definitions is throat.
It's why you and I kind of bump on each other sometimes, communication, because we have two different ways that we have channels going right to the throat. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Rami has open throat, and so does Eric. Chauncey, what's his fucking fake name?
Chauncey Hazelton. I don't know anymore.
I can't remember.
It's at also all. Eric. We've said it a billion times.
Yep, it's all good. So I was walking the dog, and I was like, trying to think of words to describe a something. And then I realized the moment I had found the words, I was like, great, I just locked that into being one thing. And then I had a realization, you can't really cement a thing into being less than what it is without words. Say I love you is not the words I want to hear from you. In other words, you can in your mind, like, okay, so let's say I'm thinking about, let's use gender as a thing, because that's a thing that some people don't like to have locked into a thing.
Right.
Like a binary, right? So if I'm thinking Rami is a girl,
mm-hmm,
and I've already decided that, I've locked Rami into a smaller thing than Rami holds themselves as being, which is not non-binary, right?
Right.
So if I out loud say with words or think in my brain, Rami is a girl, it's the words and the thinking that cement Rami into being a smaller thing than what Rami is. But if I just look at Rami, let's say I have open throat and I'm looking at a Rami human and I notice Rami's features and I have no words and I'm aware that Rami sort of looks, I don't know, more non-binary than the person next to them.
Right.
Right. And I just notice that, but I don't put words around it.
Sure.
Words being representations of concepts.
Yeah.
Then I haven't I can't lock Rami into being smaller than what Rami is. I'm just noticing Rami.
Right. You're just seeing Rami without describing Rami.
Yeah. So it's almost like if you have open throat makes it challenging sometimes to find the right words to lock into something. And that's an open throat people, the not self of the open throat is, I should be finding better words. I have to figure out how to talk. If I don't talk, I'm invisible. Mm. I don't exist if I don't talk. But the truth is they're free to be silent when they don't have words. And this all came to me because I was thinking about something with Eric where he's so silent so often in moments where I'm like trying to categorize and put words around it. And then oftentimes I'll be like halfway through figuring out the words, I'll be like, we don't need words on this. Words just make it be a thing that it doesn't need to be.
Yeah.
Except for when a thing needs to be a thing, and then you need somebody with definition in the throat to put words on it. But when it doesn't need to be a thing, I was like, oh, that's the spiritual gift of the open throat, is those are people who are already inclined to not really put words around a thing that might be this or that or a little bit of both.
I like that. That is interesting. Yeah. The idea that like the power of not defining something, the beauty of not defining something.
And they say in human design teachings that the open centers in one's chart or design are the God centers. Some people call it that, meaning you can meet the divine everywhere you're open. Where you have definition and fixation, it's harder to meet the divine because it's rigid and fixed. It's closed.
Right. And you've made your decisions about how it works or how those things operate.
Well, it's not even about decisions. It's just in your body, in the places that have definition, those places are just not open. So it's harder to, you can't like meet a new energy in a place where there's no door.
Right.
And what's, okay, now we're going to veer. I have a whole thing I could veer off into off of that. But back to the main point here, when you have open throat and you're totally open and you can't find the words, well, what if there's a gift in that? And what if you lean into the gift of it? And the gift is, you're not going to lock things into being in a way that those of us who need to lock things into being with words tend to do.
I definitely feel that.
I see that. Don't you see that with Rami? I see it with Eric all the time. I'm like, he's just being over there. And I'm looking for the judgment-based word that's going to put that thing in a category. He's like, I'm just present to the thing.
That's funny because that's something I've seen myself doing more lately and being in judgment of my, like worrying that when I'm just being and not discussing something to death or clarifying or even responding verbally, that's the challenge, not responding verbally. Then I'm like, oh, I'm an asshole. I've just been sitting here staring blankly. And they probably think blah, 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 blah. But like, I have noticed way more often that I'm doing that.
Yeah. You know what that is though? That's the not self of the open ego. When I feel hurt, envy, lack, I get busy trying to prove I have worth and value.
Right.
So I'm lacking words. I better say words, otherwise I have no worth and value.
Right. Rather than the freedom to just be.
To give up.
To give up that need to.
Yeah. Give up the need to say.
Word.
Yeah, interesting.
Now, it was just pointed out to me that, wait, what's the most rare of the designs? Reflector? No.
Yeah.
Projector. Reflectors. Mm-hmm. They have no definition anywhere. Is that true?
Yeah.
That's what makes them reflectors.
Right. In no definition in any centers. They have sometimes, they have gates and channels.
But none of their centers are defined.
I'm sorry. They can't have channels. They have gates.
Right. Because the channel has to connect to things that are. So you can have things that are open, but there's still some fill in on the little
gates,
skinny lines.
In other words, so remember, like a gate is a line that comes off of a center that does not go across,
right,
forming a channel.
Right.
Now, and if you remember, gates that hang off of open centers are the curriculum of your life.
Right.
So if you're a reflector with like a bunch of gates, all you have is the curriculum of your life, but no definition and total inconsistency. So they say for reflectors to make decisions, it takes a lunar cycle,
right?
A month.
How do you know many reflectors?
I know we had one on here. Oh God, you'll know her name. I'll forget it. Improv lady, Marin.
Rachel.
Yep.
Oh, she's a reflector.
Yep.
But that was before we were talking about that stuff very much.
And yeah. I was wishing after she came on that she also took a class or two with me. And now that I understand reflectors better, there's so many things I would have coached her differently with that probably could have been more helpful to her.
Yeah. A reflector has been offered up to us as a guest.
Oh!
So I'll follow up with you on that.
Yes!
Someone passed along a name, said, hey, this person's a reflector and I just met them and I think you should have them on the podcast. And
I'd love to. And I dated a reflector for years in Sacramento, my buddy Sarah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I'll tell this quick story and then we'll let our guest in. I see Sarah always say, he's so funny. He was such an interesting case because once I learned about reflectors, the first thought I had was, sounds like he's a reflector. And he fucking was. And it was because anytime I'd be like, God, this hard thing is happening in my life, I should probably do blank, right? He'd be like, nah, I'd say just wait. And then like a week would go by and I'd be like, well, it's been a week. I probably have to call them, right? He'd be like, I'd say just wait. And I'd be like, it's been a week.
I can't wait a week.
Then 2 weeks would go by and he'd be like, nah, don't do anything. Just wait. Then it started to show up in relational stuff where they're kind of juggled a bunch of ladies at once. He always had a bunch of ladies and they never knew about each other and he didn't have any problem with it. You know, sometimes they knew about each other. Sometimes they didn't. He was just like, eh. He had no point of view. He had no fixation. He had no judgment.
Reference points.
And then I'd say so he'd tell me a story about a girlfriend he was having a fight with. And I'd be like, wow, that sounds like that's like the fourth fight you guys have had about that. Are you guys going to stay together? He'd be like, yeah, I don't know. And I'd be like, are you going to break up? Nah, I'm going to wait. Are you going to stay together? I'm not sure. He just never answered anything ever. Until one day he'd just either be broken up with them or not. And it would usually be them who did it. And sometimes I'd be like, whatever happened to Kathy? I don't see her around. He'd be like, yeah, I haven't seen her in a while.
That sounds like a maddening human to interact with because no fixed point of anything. And you're like, nothing's reliable. There's no.
However, he had gates, right? So he had certain things he was learning about. So he was really interested in acquiring. He's a painting contractor and a home. He owns 26 houses. He's a landlord. So he was obsessed with.
Do you think he gives a shit when his people have mice?
He definitely gave a shit if you paid rent or not on time.
Interesting.
And he was very acquisitive. He used to call it, I like to acquire things. So he was learning about money acquisition, control, power, and he had a ton of, he was a very successful dude. Because what he cared about, what he was invested in, he was invested in. But relationally, he needed a lunar cycle to know. And then by then, why not wait some longer time? Because it'll play out.
Because the thing that was happening has played out already.
Yeah, it'll figure out. It'll happen or it won't. And I used to drive me nuts. And then I understood. There's another thing about reflectors. This is the last thing. And we'll let Donetta in. They have a sampling aura, which there's a lot to say about that. But one thing about the sampling aura is they can feel they can take in broken winged birds a lot because there's a way that reflector people are so open-centered and so open in general that they are very non-judging. They're incredibly non-judging. And with their sampling aura, it makes people feel seen and heard to be near them. Sampling aura is like, if I had sampling aura, I'm taking your aura in and reflecting it back to you. And then this person, everybody in the room, I'm taking their aura in and reflecting it back. So you feel very connected, very seen and heard. Teal Swan is a reflector.
Ah.
And when I would look at Zerk's life, he had 90 broken winged bird women around him. They were including myself.
Were you one of them? Yeah.
Yes, 1,000,000%. That's why we dated. Because he was so non-judging, really.
Yeah.
In a time where all I needed was anyone at all to be in my life and not judge me. Didn't matter anything else. And he was really good at that. And we're still friends because of it, actually, because he's such a non-judging force.
Cool.
Yeah, they're really interesting creatures.
I like this.
Yeah.
Follow up on this idea. Go deeper on the reflector, the unicorn of the human design world.
Indeed.
Well, I'm sorry we didn't get to catch up on you, but we'll do probably more. And then because we're letting Donetta in.
Hey, what's up? It's Rami. I had a really hard conversation with a very dear friend maybe 3 days ago. And my brain was just spinning, just going like a motor ever since, basically. That night, I think I cumulatively got about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours of sleep, just because I was so wired from our conversation. And I know that I have open head and open ajna in the human design world. I have open head, in case you're wondering, I have open head, open ajna, open throat, and open ego / heart. Anyway, I know that the freedom of the open head is to not think. I am free to not think, which sounds amazing. And this is something that I have not figured out for myself at all, because that sounds great. But the motor is going. I don't want to be thinking those thoughts. You know, I mean, I know that's why we do things like meditation and it's hard work and we train ourselves. But like with the open throat, the freedom is to be silent. Like, okay, I can do that. I can just not talk, but I can't just not think when that brain is going. And so in order to not think, I have to work very hard to continue to return to the present, or to focus on my body or my breath or anything that can, or distract myself with something, you know? But like, it doesn't feel like a freedom when I have to work so hard to make it happen. That is my current sort of question / dilemma. Thank you for listening. Rami's Rules.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing so well. Thanks.
Thanks for being here with us.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So you're welcome here to the, for our listeners, we've both been looking at your whole life and it's so wonderful and fascinating.
Well, your digital life, I'm sure it's completely, it's the only thing that is you.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I let people know.
So you're a playwright and an actor and you've worked in so many mediums and you live in
Columbia, South Carolina.
Oh, currently.
It is where I'm from and where I have currently relocated since the fall. Yeah.
Got you. Okay, cool. And I ask that mostly to ask you, how do you know Sophia, who sent you to us?
I was running through the numbers in my head. I've known Sophia for about 23 years. I was in graduate.
Get out of here.
Yeah, no. I was in graduate school in 2000 and she was an undergrad. You know, I came in and I was, I'm trying to remember, but I think I was the only Black person in my, year that came in. And there was a greater population of African-American students in the undergrad. And so we rocked together. And I was young going into graduate school, which, you know, I do not recommend all totally, but
nope,
I came.
I have thoughts about that. What kind of grad program was it?
It was for acting. I came right out of undergrad at the College of Charleston, and I was such a baby cakes. And I go into this grad program, and I'm like, I can do things the same way I did when I was an undergrad. And it's
no,
most certainly can't. And I wish I had a little bit more life experience, you know. And
did you get that from your teachers? Were they, this was my experience, I don't know if you share it, but like they're just constantly going, you need more to draw on because we're working with what you've got and there's nothing there, basically.
Oh, no, there was, honestly, I got the opposite. There was an assumption that there was more there.
Oh.
I think, listen, I've always had this voice and I've always sort of had a bigger presence. I'm 5'2", but every time I get off stage, people go, oh my God, you're a tiny little person. And I'm like, yeah, you know, so they had this image of me that I was older than I was, that I was wiser than I was. And for me, just underneath that, there just felt like a need to sort of meet that. But what I really was experiencing were the things of a very young person, you know, that I think that I just needed to go out in the world and experience. I needed to fail more. I needed to find my own little hoorays and yays. And I hadn't at that point. I'd kind of been, you know, and this is such a blessing that I came from my parents' home into undergrad, into grad school, like I was being taken care of. But I think that there's value in failure, and not just inside of the arts, but inside life. And I needed to fail bigger and more complicated inside of life before I started graduate school. Now I learned things. I did. And they carried me on into my professional career. But I think like living life outside of that made me a better artist, you know. But I rushed into it, and there was there was tremendous value, like I said. But at the end of the day, I think I probably would have waited at least a year or two, you know, just to be out in the world and see if I could make some ends meet.
Do you find that, because I would imagine that when you said I've always had this voice, mm-hmm. I hadn't yet categorized or thought about what your voice was or wasn't, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
When you pointed to it, I went, oh, I think I see what you're pointing to.
Yeah.
It has a distinct set of qualities that I could see people projecting consistent things onto.
Yeah.
And namely age and wisdom, kind of.
Yeah.
So I wonder, how has that played out for you as an actor? Like, have people sort of said, okay, you'll be playing the 50-year-old wise woman?
Oh, yeah.
When you were like 28?
All the time. I played older and I played men, you know. More so when I was in high school, I played a probably more regal, you know, because I had like this sort of authoritative sort of presence. And in undergrad, I think I was given a lot more breath to be a little bit more versatile. In grad school, it was sort of a fight to play women. Mm. And, Sophia can attest to that. I had to like beg in my third year to like, I think I need to, you know, learn how to play women and romantic leads just in case somebody wants me to play a woman when I'm, you know, out in the professional world at some point. And then professionally, it has been consistent that I've been like, you know, administrators, cops, things like that.
Yep. Same here.
Nurses.
Right.
You know, it's just like you have like no nonsense, you know? Like,
yep.
And
yep.
Like for the life of me, I told my manager, you know, after a while, I said, listen, I want all the nonsense they can bring. I'm like, please, God, just give me some nonsense to work with.
Yeah.
If everything is like played straight and it's like you go from show to show and you're playing essentially the same character.
Thing. Yeah.
So you don't necessarily get to grow in those ways. So it's a good thing to have other wells of creativity to draw from, you know.
And did you move, if I may, you tell us whatever you don't want to share, obviously. Did you move back to South Carolina because of the current upswing in production in places like Atlanta and like the Southeast has a lot of production now? Or is it more that you're focusing on playwriting so you don't need to be in the hubs or whatever? Like, what's your point of view about living in South Carolina and working as an actor?
Well, so this is home. And I think that, you know, and my family's here during lockdown, during the pandemic, I kind of realized that, you know, the virtual meeting space was not going to go anywhere. I had like one of my best auditions online for the last show that I did, the Skin of Our Teeth at LTC. And so LCT, excuse me.
Is that Louisiana?
No, Lincoln Center.
Lincoln Center.
Oh, duh.
LCT.
Yeah, no. LCT. Yeah.
When it was LTC, we were confused.
So sorry. Like, I got to just say the thing, Lincoln Center. So, you know, it started to become really clear that you could be based where you needed to be based. And I had kind of had a you know, very blessed again to have had such a long career to kind of still have the feeling of being in New York, but I'm, you know, but I'm home with my folks. And over the years I've had, I've told my family so many times, you know, I can't do it. You know, I'm in production, I'm in rehearsal. It's, you know, I have this audition, I have to be here, and I can't. And I think, you know, the urgency that just like from that period of time of the pandemic, I was like, I got to get home. I got to see, you know, every time I go home, the nieces and nephews are taller, you know, the parents, their hair is grayer. And, you know, it was time. It was time. Yeah.
Rock on. That's very cool. So I'm hearing you say, tell me if this is correct.
Yeah.
I'm hearing you say your values, mm-hmm. you know, you realized more about your own values, which include more family time and more connection with family, and that the technology of current audition processes means that you can really be anywhere and commute or travel or fly to do a show or to do TV or whatever.
Absolutely. That's right. There's a direct flight from Columbia to New York. So I'm, you know, back and forth there. And the even in the few months that I have been home, the quality of life, just knowing that like my family can depend on me for certain things now.
Yeah.
Is awesome. It is awesome. Like I've gone to a couple of, you know, games that, you know, my nephew had a little flag football game I was able to go to. And I was like, oh, this is, you hear about it being away and you're like, oh, that's so cute. But the value of just being in the stands and seeing him like light up that you're there. And,
I know.
You know, it's nothing beats it.
I really get it. Yeah, I've had my own journey with a very similar set of things. I remember one time I was doing a play up in, I was at Capitol Stage, and I remember I was in the time of life in my 20s where I don't know, I'd been offered a something, and then it was like somebody was having a wedding. And I remember we were talking in the green room about, I was like, no, I'm not going to your fucking wedding. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like I said it out loud like that.
Yeah.
And I remember the stage manager at the time, I could say, I know who it was. I don't want to out anybody's opinions about things, but he looked at me like, wow. And I was like, what, would you like go to a wedding instead of take a job? And he was like, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah.
And then there was another actor in the cast who said, yeah, you know, honestly, because I was being so opinionated and strong about it that most people were like, I know, right? You take a job.
Yeah, yeah.
But these two people were just sort of quiet in the background. And I was like, what's going on with them? So I asked. And the woman who was in the cast was like, yeah, I kind of would do the wedding too. And at the time, I was so fixated on this as the only thing and the priority, because honestly, for me, my childhood with my family wasn't super great. So I had deprioritized family all the way off the map.
Yeah, yeah.
And just, it was just career, career, career. So then it's only in the recent past couple of years where I've personally come around to, like, I've just changed a lot. And all of a sudden I'm like, I'm just like, let's find out whose wedding is when, and then see if I can do a little play.
Right, right, right. Well, you know, it's twofold. It's like, yes,
you want work.
You want work. You want work. And the you've set your lifestyle to earn a living, to pay your rent, to feed yourself. So sometimes you have to say, well, you know, I would really want to be there, but I actually cannot. Or
right.
You say, you know what, I'm going to forfeit that, see if I can make up some money on the back end some other way, but I'm going to be at this wedding. You know what I mean?
Or you ask the people in casting like, hey, so I can do this, but on this weekend, I can.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what,
that's the thing I've been noticing maybe more of late because of a shift in like this whole idea that actors have started to say we get to stand up for ourselves and have be treated better. So there's a little bit more movement towards that, more coverage on understudies because of COVID, woomty woomp, all that. But it's still, it's weird because like for me, I work at a certain level where like if I were doing a show at Capitol Stage, I'd be more likely to be like, eh, whatever. But if it was a Berkeley rep, I'd be like, I'll just take that at work, however I possibly can, right?
Right, right.
But it's actually the reverse of that. All the places I've seen that are an actor, like a friend of mine has gone on as an understudy at a major theater because they had it predetermined that the actor that they hired was going to be gone that weekend because they got to prioritize their life.
Yeah.
So there is that exists as a possibility, but it's not, it's more baked in maybe at the higher levels, quote, higher levels, than it is at the lower levels.
I mean, you could argue easily that's because they can afford it.
That the company can do it, right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Capital stage would have a harder time switching someone in and out, maybe,
right,
because of resources and energy they don't have to give, whereas Berkeley Rep can. But also, I think you're speaking to a thing where, I know for myself as an actor, I got to a place before the world caught up where I was like, well, fuck them. Like, I'm going to say I have a fucking wedding, and if they don't want me, then fuck them. Because for me, that's just me, though. I don't say that that's the right way to be. That's just like, I have such a sensitive nervous system that I just was like, I'm not going to give up fun stuff with people I love anymore to suffer for an extra weekend for not enough money. Now, if it were like a TV show, I would approach it more delicately, but I would still approach it because I matter enough to myself now to prioritize it, whether they've caught up or not. That being said, thank God they're catching up.
Thank God they're catching up. But the thing is, like, as soon as you have those things aligned, then you lose nothing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's like,
yes.
I'm not going to be able to do it on these 3 days.
Right.
Can you afford to get? No. Okay. I feel good in my soul.
Exactly.
I feel good in my soul. It's fine.
There's
it's
no fine. Conflict internally anymore because
I spoke from alignment. I'm disappointed it didn't happen perfectly, but.
Yeah. And also it's like the pie is big enough. You know, it's like, please, please give it to someone who has availability and wants it and needs it maybe more than I do or whatever. It's going to balance out at a certain point.
That's nice. I like that. This is so random.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been in an episode of The Walking Dead?
No, God, that wasn't me. That was the other lady.
that there's two shows in my head where I'm like, I feel like I've seen you. And I've been asking myself where, and I've looked at your IMDb.
Yeah.
The Wrestler might be the other one.
Yeah.
And is the Wrestler the one with Marky Mark? No,
that's the boxer.
Mickey Rourke.
The boxer.
Yeah. Mickey Rourke is the wrestler. That's funny. Mickey Rourke and Marky Mark sounded similar too.
Yeah. Rhythmically, they're fine. Yeah. Mickey Rourke.
Yeah, I remember. So for Mickey, do you mind telling, who'd you play? What was your, tell us
so
about that one.
Evan Rachel Wood played his daughter, and I played her girlfriend.
Oh, God, I totally remember. Okay, I've got nothing left up here.
Yeah, and I, basically, my big moment was when he came to the door, I cussed him out, like I gave him what for.
Fun.
So I was standing up for my lady.
Uh-huh.
Now I just have to ask, since you were on screen, it was a long time ago, I know, but like
so when I was a child.
Was he weird?
Was
he weird?
No, he was quite kind. He was quite kind. No, he was all
right. I was wondering about him.
You know, there are actors who've been in the game for a long time who I've worked with, and I've always had this feeling of like being a beginner at any stage of filming that I was in. Like either was my first episode or something, or I'm like my, you know, fifth episode or something. I've always felt like I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm so happy to be here, you know? But there are seasoned actors who are just like, who know how to do the thing. And so they are dropped in a different way that maybe sometimes I'm like me, who's like, what's that? Pretty lights. Oh God. It's like, I got a job. Thank goodness. You know?
Yeah.
Where they're just like, here's the thing that we got to do, you know? And it might seem eccentric, you know, from the outside in, and sometimes I, you know, stare at some folks but they have their own process in the way that they work. But I think if I'm remembering, because this was a very long time ago, very, very professional and kind, and just, you know, wanting to get the thing right.
That's cool.
That's good to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And would you say that for you these days, do you feel inside of yourself that you're, do you have a focus on playwriting versus performing, or do they live sort of evenly for you inside?
They live evenly. They may not be expressed evenly at the moment.
Of course. Right. Yeah. I get it.
You know, you know, to be fair, the last acting gig I did for stage was Skin of Our Teeth. And that was, what was that now? It was over a year ago. No. And, But I mean, what an amazing last project to have done in the vast scheme of things. And right now, what's happening is I have commissions with several theater companies, and so I'm working on development for a television project for AMC. And so those things happen, but then I get like starved for performance, you know. But there's a thing like I'm working on this piece for the Alabama Shakespeare Festival, and you know, we're gonna have a workshop of it in February, and we have just a really great cast. And the when I did a previous workshop of it, I was inside of it. But for me as a writer, it's so much more helpful if I'm not in it to see if what I've written is translatable, right? Like inside the hands of a really gifted actor. So, you know, I told one of the actors, like, yeah, I'm not going to be in it this time. They're like, what? What do you mean? I was like, I'm not really, I don't necessarily write for opportunities to perform, to be honest with you. Even with the last solo show I did, Where We Stand, I went kicking and screaming into that show. the producers will tell you, like, they're like, no, you should do this, you should perform it. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to do that. I didn't write it necessarily for me. I had another, actor in mind, but I did it, and you know, it turned out really well, and I got to split time with another one of my favorite actors, David Ryan Smith, and share the role as a solo show and from different nights, you know, because I want to have that sort of it lives beyond me feeling as a player. I keep telling people, no, I'm a writer for other actors. I'm a writer for actors. Like, I love actors, you know, and I want us to have like meat, and I don't want to keep it just for myself to exercise some kind of skill or something. I'm interested in, like, can this complicated thought live in somebody else's body, and can it live in the conversation of theater? Does it stop here? And I don't ever want it to stop with me and say it can only be done inside of her body. This play can only be moved inside of here, and we don't really know what her intention was. I want to always put it down on paper and have somebody else interpret it. So yeah. So, but when I write, I think I act out everything. So I'm.
You read your work out loud while you're writing sometimes, and just say it in the room.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If not out loud, just mumbling to myself. It's real sexy stuff. But I think that training from acting lives inside of the work as a playwright. Yeah.
So what comes to mind when I'm listening to you talk is, were you always this integrous your entire life? I had to work really hard to get to a place where I was anywhere near as integrous as you sound.
Oh boy.
Meaning like, I mean, I would have whored myself hard for so much nonsense. And I did. Like, how did you...
Listen, my work is defined. It's like comes from me, right? Like, I mean, I'm talking about blackness, queerness, and southernness,
right?
Do you know what I mean? So I'm gonna be there whether you like it or not. Do you know what I
right.
mean? So it's like, just can it live in other bodies? And is it a complicated enough story to demand conversation, to demand like real emotion about it, as opposed to just being something that I'm just sort of meditating on by myself? It's meant to be more this way.
So the answer is yes. You've always been this integrous. Because here's my, it's, and you make an excellent point if you're writing. I mean, I wrote 6 solo shows and they're all about me. And yeah, I guess you could say they're pretty true or whatever, but I had the kind of trauma as a child that led to a need and desire to have and take and pull in approval at all costs until I was conscious and started to work with it. And I'm still always growing as a person on a healing path. But my point being, to be able to say something like, it's not just for me, it's for other people, like that took me 15, 20 years of...
Listen, I wrote my first solo show called The Cowboy Is Dying, and that was definitely about me, right? And it was also, I wrote it both out of necessity and as a challenge to myself as a performer, right? So like that was for me. And it was a necessity because we had a theater company. Sophia was a part of it as well, called Kylie Rep. And we had a solo show festival. And so I had an idea for a solo show. I wrote it, and I had the beginnings of a thing. I didn't know what it was about. And I interviewed a lot of directors, and I'm like, I don't know what this is. And the first director who said, I don't know what this is, along with me, I was like, you're hired. This is great. So I did that, but there were things that I needed to do as an actor. Like, there was a kind of bravery that I think that I needed. I needed to be able to sing, and I just didn't allow myself to do it. I was scared. So I wrote like a bunch of music to sing inside of it too. And it was personal. And, you know, and I think when you are young, I was 20 something, I don't know. And just there's so many complications about just the world and like identity and surviving and love and all of those things that I think I just needed to get out of my body.
I get that.
That particular show will probably never be done again.
I hear what you're saying.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm so glad I did it. And I don't feel any kind of way about it not being done again, because I think it was good for that moment.
Yeah.
But it's a good read.
Sure.
And like, I'm like, oh, I could study and gain some things from it. But that was a moment. And then I kind of grew out of there. And I'm like, there's certain things that I liked about that. You know, I liked some of the language. So then it began technical, right? Like, I liked the language. I like how I played with music. Like, how can I make another story inside of that? That isn't about me, that I can have a little distance, but it's still kind of about me, but it has a little distance.
You know? Yeah. As you're talking, I'm just like, that's cool. This is a pure artist we're talking with. Like, you're just someone who's been thinking about what's in the highest good of the work and what do you need to say. You're an artist. I mean, I'm putting a label on you, but like, my interpretation of you is that there's an integrous authenticity and an integrity that is born of a real specific artistic need. Like, I had the need to be seen, to be heard, and to express myself. And so I did these things and they did that. But I also had some needs that were born of like traumatic. They're just not really real needs. They were needs that I thought if I got them met, they would meet a certain, like, I was going for like fame and money and status, because I thought that would fill the spiritual void and whatever. Meanwhile, I was trying to make work I cared about, but it was like when I was younger, I was making very integrous solo stuff and only doing shows I wanted to do, very integrous. And then I got like lost somewhere along the way where it was like, gotta get that job. And like, gotta get that job came before anything else. And I really lost the integrity in that journey for a while. And then I've sort of refound it in recent years, but not in the form, in a whole different form. Whereas I hear you talking and you sound to me, and you tell me where I'm off here, but like someone who's just been listening internally for what is true, what is real, what is the actual thing I need to do in a real way all along somehow. Does that seem right? Or maybe it's just that voice of yours that I can project on.
If I were to say, fame is very important. You see, like, it sounds like...
It is.
Sounds like an authority.
Yeah.
No, I mean, who doesn't have a desire,
right,
to be wildly successful in what we do?
Yeah, but who is willing to sell themselves out and who is not?
Listen, I've been challenged by that.
Okay.
I've been challenged by that. And I have done projects where I'm like, why am I here?
Right.
You know, where it's like the opportunity didn't kind of meet where I wanted to be. And I knew it.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about that check.
Right.
And it felt crappy at the end of the day. It felt crappy at the end of the day. So I think that it's just the nature of the beast in some aspects of it. So I would, some of us get bit by it a little bit harder than others, but gosh, I think like even the most integrous person, like if somebody says, listen, we will set you up so you can do the things that you want on the side, but you got to do this thing.
Yeah.
you want to consider that thing. You know what I mean? It's like, wait a minute.
For sure.
I got to consider some shit. So it's it's not, I don't know. I don't think
it's not black and white.
It's not black and white. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I hear
you. Yeah. I think that, you know, on the opposite end of that, you can be so dismissive of success opportunity that you cloud like what you're blessing those opportunities for yourself, like make yourself smaller than you are.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
you can run into that trap too. Like they can
How do you Yeah, then in the face of what you're saying, which is so true and so right on, I wonder the question that comes up for me next for you personally is how have you navigated, like what tools did you have internally or did you have to develop along the way to navigate all the pain and the rejection and the difficulty of this life that some of us have chosen? Like, what do you do about it?
Yeah, you know, I think about when I first started doing this thing for real, came out of grad school, and I used to journal. And but, you know, it's so funny because, you know, how so I'm Southern Baptist. And but there, you know, there was recently at the online church that I attend, the pastor was talking about, you know, you don't when you pray, you don't just ask for stuff. Praying is not just asking for it. It's not transactional, right? But the way that I was journaling was just that. So I wrote in my journal, if I don't get this Nickelodeon commercial, that like, that's the end. You know, I put so many stakes in what it, like, I became so, like the journaling wasn't for a spiritual journey.
Right.
It was mostly about that stuff you're talking about, like success and making it and doing the thing. Like, that's it. Like, that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then I think I had failed in these ways that, I don't know. It's painful. It's painful to hear no. It's painful to be in the third callback and then not get it. It's like, it is brutal. Like, people outside of the business may not quite understand, but you are the only person walking into that room and you are self-directing. You know, these are the choices that I've made, and I've made myself vulnerable.
Yes.
It's like, I'm basically standing before you naked. This is my work, you know, and to then be told no, or you're not tall enough, or you're not whatever.
Yes.
It hurts. And I think that is actually when I started zeroing in on that written work. I mean, after the solo show, was like, I need to get this thing out of my system. And then I was like, you know what? I am not the total of this rejection. Right. And I was like, I actually am a smart lady who likes to tell stories. And if I fail here on this page by myself, that's okay. It's so good. Let me just fail easy here in front of myself. And then I said, okay, let me fail in front of some friends. And I said, can we get together and read some pages? Okay, sure. This is all right. Okay, it's all right. Okay. And then I kept failing and failing and failing until I like failed into a playwriting career that I started off apologizing for. I did my first reading of this. Oh, my first play. It's called The B Factor. It is gloriously terrible. Like, I love it. It's so bad. But I did it at this company called Ptosis, The Other Side of Silence, a legendary like queer downtown theater company in New York that was then led by Doric Wilson. May he rest in peace. And it was my first ever playwriting like reading. And before the show like even started, I had friends in there. I'm just like, it's, you know, I'm an actor. So, you know, don't even worry. I'm an actor. Yeah. Just apologizing for the work immediately.
I see.
You know, and Doric pulled me aside and, you know, I've told the story 100 times, but I love it. He pulled me aside and said, you have to stop doing that.
Yeah.
You're a writer.
Right.
So, you know, so act like one.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, gotcha.
That's similar to like what we often have done as actors where we're, I would say, so, oh, what do you do? I'm an actor. I mean, I also teach. Don't worry.
Right, right, right. Apologize. Yeah.
Don't worry. I also do things that make money.
That's right. Yeah. I'm not taking up the space. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But then I think as I was like, I have the capacity of for creativity inside of storytelling and by other means, or by like being a better human being sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, actually, let me just connect with my friends. Let me like reach out to my family. Let me just like settle back into who I am.
Yeah.
Became a better actor.
Yes.
Because I was able to let some things go. Okay. It's like, yeah. All right, like the world is not that Nickelodeon audition.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Right?
Like you will finish, you know, you'll do something else tomorrow and you'll be told no tomorrow, but then you'll be told yes the day after tomorrow. Who knows? You don't know. But keep your creative engine kind of going in some capacity. And like you called me an artist, but I see no reason not to call you an artist, right? Are you not an artist?
No, I hear you. No,
you know what I mean?
I hear that. It's just that there's a way that you're describing when I say the phrase, you're correct. You're right. To say pure artist versus not is a little too binary. But my point is that as you describe the process you've been going through on all levels, I hear a real return over and over again to a connection with self,
yeah,
and an understanding of the value and importance of that. And in a way, I think my privilege, like I have like all the privileges of being a white lady from like a Jewish upper middle class white place in the world. And then I went to the colleges and it wasn't that hard for a long time. And I have all that. But blended with that, I have like a ton of like very bad trauma that should never happen to a baby and a child that happened. So it's not just one thing. So I've never really identified as like, I'm just a trauma victim. I'm just a rich white lady. It's like, I don't know what the fuck. It's an ongoing journey of becoming a person. My point being, though, as we're talking, I'm like, there is a kind of element of my privilege coming from like passing as totally straight in the world. Always, my whole life, when I'm not an arrow.
Yeah, I didn't get that. I didn't.
You didn't have that one. That one doesn't.
Yeah. So passing and then looking like the hair is a little more femme and then like whiteness and like all the privilege that comes with that. Almost like as I'm listening to it, it's like it sets us up to be forced to confront who we really are less. Like queerness and blackness, you know. It shows up in the room first for other people, right? And so you're either gonna, in a way, it's kind of like I'm always giving my boyfriend shit about his parents bought him this condo. He was a working jazz musician, and his like rich lawyer parents were like, here, live here comfortably forever. And I never had anybody handing me those things. And I was hustling my ass and working hard to get things. And he was crippled a bit by what they handed him. And there are these ways that I watch him, his development as a person. And this is not a condemnation of him. Truly, I love this man. I live here. I benefit from his parents' choices. Thank you, God. However, what I'm saying is there are ways he's been crippled by it developmentally that I actually wouldn't trade. Like the growth I had to experience from the challenges. So as I'm listening to him, I'm just wondering out loud. I'm sort of going, had I been me with whatever trauma I had and black and visibly queer in some more way than I already am, like what, I don't know, might I have been pushed into deeper integrity questions sooner or in a different way? Maybe not. Maybe that's fully irrelevant. Maybe it's really just your human design. It makes me want to look at your chart, but you have a quality about you that I'm like, I want to know the source of this intent. Like you're just rooted in yourself is the feeling I get. And even the way you talk and the way you answer questions, the thoughtfulness and the connectedness to yourself, it makes me go, did you have amazing parents?
I did.
See?
I was just about to say.
There it is. Damn it. I went down the wrong route. Well, we got to something. Tell us about your parents.
No, they are maybe like they're the best people on the planet.
Okay.
They've been together they will be together for 50 years come September.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Like happily?
Yeah, happily.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So.
So they're unicorns.
So my name is Donetta Lavinia. And my sisters and I all have the same initials because D is what my dad's name starts with. And L is what my mom's name starts. So we all grew up DLG. Our family lore starts with their love story. So we understood something about like romance and longevity and that kind of integrity. It was also, you know, we're a military family. And, you know, the military doesn't pay all together that much. So my mom like worked two jobs while my dad like did all of the traveling, and they decided to, as a couple, like, okay, we're going to stay in this one particular area in South Carolina where the schools are really good. It's closer to my mom's mom, my grandmama. And so I got to grow up like in a uniquely different way than other like army brats would, you know, I don't have a second language unless you count like country ass, you know. So there was something really stable about it, but that was also just a matter of how we operated to have integrity that way.
Well, see, that's what I'm saying. If you're born and raised inside of an integrous system, you internalize it and it becomes the template for what being is. So I just admire it. I think it's a beautiful thing, and I crave more of it in myself. And I feel like the majority of the work I do on myself is just to have more of that.
But I will tell you, there is a flip side of that where, you know, you want to follow the rules. You want to be a little bit perfect. You want to be kind all the time. You want to be nice. You want to not ruffle feathers in a way. So then sometimes inside of that, you lose a little bit of who you are sometimes, you know, so there, you know what I mean? So I'm always kind of going, because I have the good kid syndrome. Like I have to be good. I have to be right. You know, so I'm in constant negotiation with, am I saying the right thing or am I saying the true thing? Am I doing the right thing or am I doing the true thing? You know, so it has taken time for me to breathe inside of conversation. Do you know, like that's been my journey of like, okay, I'm going to perform the right thing. I've always been applauded for being the quiet kid, the good kid, that kind of thing. Mm. Okay. So when you deviate from that a little bit, it's kind of dangerous. And so like the biggest thing was like coming out. It's like, okay, like
sure.
this was like the kid, you know, the favorite kid, what have you. And so then like all the dream shattering and then like the dream rearranging had to happen around like identity. But so the care in like how I communicate went from being careful not to ruffle feathers to careful if I'm being honest with myself. And it took me a lot of time to say, what do I want? Which, you know, in therapy, when I first started therapy, I told my therapist, I hate that. That's my least favorite question. Mm-hmm. It gives me so much rage. I hate it. Don't ask me what I want, because whatever you want to do, you know, I don't know what I want. And she's like, let's start slow. What do you like? What are your favorite colors? Like, what do you like, little things, so that then I can tackle the bigger things. So I think, you know, everybody has a little bit of their something that they're working toward when it comes to truth, you know, but you are right in that the evolution of my art still comes from finding someplace at center, right? Like, what is the truth that I'm kind of digging for, right? Coming back. It's even like symbolic of me coming back home. It's like, I need to understand. I when I was in college, I would just go home for the weekend because I'm like, I need to realign my tires. I need to get back to what it is I know. And then I can go back out in the world and be ready.
That's nice.
Yeah,
that's
lovely really that nice. You had that to return
exactly.
to. That pole existed.
Oh, yeah.
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 Absolutely. Absolutely.
Really cool. This is going to seem very tangential and random, but I have to ask because I'm so impressed by you as a human being. What's your favorite acting project you've been a part of? On screen on stage, and then what's your favorite writing project you've been a part of?
Oh, no.
You can take that to mean. I know.
You gotta pick a baby.
I know.
Oh, no.
It's just fun.
Let's see. My favorite TV project, I have to say, was a short-lived show called Happy.
Oh, yeah.
Did you remember Happy?
I haven't seen it, but I watched your reel of that.
Thank you. And the reason why I like that, yeah, I was playing like another government agent, but I was mean, you know, like I had like, I was villainous, and that was a lot of fun to play with. Also, my partner in crime, Atkins, who is a fantastic actress. And Chris Maloney, I feel like I follow around New York City. You know, I did SVU, and I saw him. I was like, oh, hey. It's like, oh, hey. It's like, if you work, I'm working. I like this. I like the way this
is. That's so cool.
So that was my most fun on TV. I think probably second most fun was Mercy, which was a lot. That was a lot of fun. A lot of big medical words I had to learn.
So first most fun was the one where you got to be villainous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it was like something different and edgier and dark, and we all like to play villains.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've played all of the social workers and things like that.
Oh, God. You know, tell me about it. For me, it's different. Oh, yeah. Scientist, lawyer, business lady.
Listen.
That's it.
I'd give anything to be a scientist or a lawyer or a business lady.
You can have it.
I've played 30 different Jamaican nurses.
Yeah, yours is worse. I get it, of course. Yeah.
God bless them because they help pay the rent. You know, but like the diversification of my portfolio is kind of nice.
That's great.
When you get to play a super, when you get to play a villain. Let's see. Oh, gosh. You're setting
putting you on the spot. I know. Well, maybe how about I frame it differently? A favorite, like a top favorite. That's better.
I had a lot of fun with Skin of Our Teeth just because, I mean, that was so meaningful to be back on stage.
Don't you find that the last show you've done, if it wasn't a nightmare, is always your most favorite show?
It was great. It was great. And I will say Men on Boats was super, super.
Oh, that's a cool play.
Oh, that is a cool play.
I mean, and Skin of Our Teeth is bananas.
It's bananas. So like the big epic, what am I doing? I don't know. Like, I kind of like those, which is interesting because there's just a lot of faith that you have. And because I think I'm so like by the books kind of thing, I love the experimental stuff. I have absolutely no idea where I'm going. I don't know what I'm doing.
For the listener, can you talk us through the bananasness of Skin of Our Teeth? What was banana? Tell us about.
Well, there was like a, I don't know, 30-foot dinosaur on stage. And the cast was massive. We had over 20 some odd cast members, more, because I think we had like 18 or 19 Broadway debuts or something. It's a massive.
It's an early 20th century, like
Thornton Wilder.
Thornton Wilder, who wrote Our Town, you know, very, seems like he's a little experimental, but it's still going to be a play about some people doing a thing. And then it just goes like bizarre and time travel, and they show up in the Jurassic era. And
yeah.
Oh my God.
End of the world, end of the war, you know, and it's about, what is it about? Like who we are.
Yeah.
You know, how we survive and how this cycles over and over again. Mm. You know, it's really us who are bringing about the end of things, you know? Yeah. I mean, that was lovely. And I think about.
And was that your Broadway debut?
No. I had two more experiences as an understudy on Broadway. But this was my first like speaking role on Broadway. Yeah.
Wow. So cool.
It's really cool. It was really, really cool. What else? So that's TV. That's
and then thing you wrote.
Oh, thing I wrote.
While you're thinking about it, I'm going to read a quote to you.
Oh, please. Yeah.
That it's on your Instagram.
It's on my Instagram. Okay.
It's a quote of a review of one of your recent plays. And I just was so struck by it because it's pretty impressive. The joy of being a theater critic is witnessing some extraordinary individuals performing at the highest levels. Equally joyful is when you review a play that blesses you spiritually, challenges your viewpoint, and changes your life forever. And that's from a critic. That was for your Last Night and the Night Before at the Steppenwolf. That's, I just was like, wow, that, oof, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, that's very humbling. It's just, it's really, you know, it's really, really beautiful because you write a thing and then you don't know how people will receive it. And I'm like, I like it. It means something to me. It means something that I placed this particular language, the language that I grew up speaking, basically, inside here as poetry, as like complicated language that you have to deal with. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In the way that you know, I mean, I can't think of our language playwrights that have like Irish and like, you know, big bold sounds in their mouth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like you have to deal with this.
You have to navigate, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a big, thick American dialect. Sit with it. And these are complicated people. And they love each other and they make bad choices and they're, you know, country and beautiful. And I love each and every one of them. I loved each and every one of them. Yeah, no, Last Night and the Night Before, I think just because it was my first big production, my first like regional production. And that Steppenwolf like said, yeah, we like it enough to do it. Like, that's wild. Like,
Jeez. That's,
you know, I had to make a speech in front of like the 100 or so people who like make Steppenwolf run, that beautiful big family there. And I'm like, you know, when you're in high school, it's a handful of theaters, you know, and Steppenwolf is like, you know, and so it was like, it's a dream come true. So that play has been held with such care. And then they produced it at my undergrad, and then they're producing it upstate South Carolina, USC upstate this winter or spring, I think. And so like it means something to people. And that, I mean, golly, that's just a lot, you know?
That's huge.
It means something. Yeah.
I'm so happy for you.
Thank you.
Really, you're really, you've killed it already and you're continuing to kill it. It's going to be very dead because of you, because of all the killing you're doing to it.
It's a lot of violent imagery we're working with suddenly.
Always, Cassidy, you've met me before. Well, there's one thing we tend to do on this podcast. We have to wrap up soon-ish, but we don't have to do this, but I do feel moved to say this to you. And we haven't even gotten into the main question I tend to ask people, which is, if I said the word spirituality to you, what does that mean and how does it relate to your creative life? So that's coming next. But another thing we can do is, I don't know what Sophia told you about what we do here in terms of this thing called the Akashic Records. She talked to you about that at all?
Yeah, a little bit. I read some. I'm not particularly clear. Yeah.
It's basically like we don't have to do this at all. And for time, it might be a bit too pushed, but I do want to hear your spirituality thoughts. I've been an energy healer a long time and went to 3 healing schools, 4 years study in each one and lots of training to do really trauma healing for myself. Cause like I said, that's been my main life's work is my own healing really. And then, something that I came out of all that training with was this skill to go into this thing called the Akashic Records, which you could say is sort of a high vibrational frequency of God's love or the divine light, or some people call it the realm of God. Other people call it the source of consciousness or the seat of consciousness. It's like, I like to think of it as the most high vibrational space in the realm of consciousness. And in that space, we can see the quote records of an individual soul, which is to say, everything you've been through in any incarnation and everything you're going through now and where you're headed, what the soul is up to is like, quote, written in the records. So people go into the Akashic Records to ask questions about purpose and job and family and career and partners and life. And it's really for people to ask questions. But what I use it for with clients too is to bring healing. So I can pull, you could say, that's sort of the wrong verb, but divine light can move through the records quite easily into any kind of heart injury or spiritual injury or emotional, psychological, physical injury and create healing for a client if the client is willing to meet up with the pain. So the records are to ask questions and to get healing on a thing. So sometimes on this podcast, what we'll do is we'll have the guest come on and we have a long talk about spirituality and or creativity. And then I go into their records here on the podcast. They ask a question or bring up a topic for healing and we do some of that. I kind of get the feeling that's not kind of what we're up to today, but that is a thing we do. And before we do it, I like to understand the person I'm speaking with a little bit better and by asking, what does spirituality mean to you? What's your relationship to that word? And then how does it apply to your life as an artist? Like, how do you apply it to your living choices on a day-to-day level?
Yeah.
Does that all make any sense?
No, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. And gosh, how do I define spirituality? Spirituality, which is different from religion.
Yes, exactly.
But there is the idea that comes from a religious practice is that, you know, if God made us in his image, then we are in communication with God whenever we are in connection with other people, you know, communication with other people. So I never feel, I think if I constantly remind myself of that, then certain things are more, I don't want to say easier, but more attainable. Like forgiveness is more attainable.
Right.
Like
right.
grace is more attainable. Like, you know, like you can, and things like coming out of failure are you can deal with them a little better.
For sure.
And I feel like for me, like we were talking about prayer earlier, is not to be transactional.
Right.
But I think that gratitude, which changes the day to day.
That's so true.
So I don't, if I ask for anything, it is protection for the people that I love. And it is just there's a constant roaring of thank you inside. Because listen, it's been a really blessed life. Even though there have been hardships, like even in this past year, it's been like a complication with transitions and moving and all of this stuff. There has still been a way for me to sit inside of I made it. You know, I'm here today. I'm here right now. Okay, this was a rough patch. I'm here. Okay. Okay. And I have the ability to deal with it.
Yes. Thank you. Beautiful.
Thank you. I even think about like when I first moved to New York and I had the world's tiniest apartment where I could reach out and touch my hand. You know, they call it a European apartment. I had to step over the toilet to get to the bathtub. And I had no money. You know, I would go down to the cart and like back in the day, you get to have like a egg on a roll and a coffee for a dollar. And it was like,
yeah,
great.
Yeah.
You know, but I remember like going to the store and getting a bag of grits and like some turkey bacon. And I was like, thank God that my mama taught me how to make grits because I can have grits for breakfast. I can have grits for lunch. I can have grits for dinner. You know what I mean? I'm like, I'm set. Like I got everything. I got everything I need. Everything I need. You know what I mean? So I like those moments of just gratitude inside of like what feels like roughness. Yeah.
When you came out, was there a struggle to reconcile with the religion?
Yeah, people always ask me that. Me and God always been cool. Like,
yeah, I get that. But I mean,
it's always the people.
Yes.
The people. The people who kind of mess things up. The people are the problem.
The people are the problem always.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think, listen, I have never been in the closet my whole professional career. And it was talking about the early aughts where it was, I mean, it's precarious now, but it was still really precarious then. Holding hands in public, that kind of stuff. And
but I mean, like with your family and your church friends, like was there pushback?
Yeah. Oh no! Listen, always,
okay.
Always,
okay.
Especially like with my queer circle of friends. For those who the church like just outright rejected them, and like I would have to sit through sermons of, you know what God intended and all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what they didn't know, and now I'm getting a little preacher, a little preachy.
Yeah, do it.
Is that I would sit in my quiet time with my God.
Mm-hmm.
And we were cool.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I do.
So it was like, it did not matter. It was rough. It was really, really rough. And I cried a lot of tears. I cried a lot of tears, but there was something that was so certain that I was kind of loved in this bigger definition of love.
I get it.
And I had a, I had to, and people were so frustrated with me, and rightfully so, because, you know, there was a real spot of meanness in my mama during that time, real spot. But I was like, you know, I think she loves me. I know she loves me, and she'll come around. She'll come around. She'll come around. She'll come around. So there was a long period of patience and maybe more grace than I needed to give. But as when I had, there was a moment where I had to put my foot down, you know, and I said, this is not going to be like this. And I'm just not going to stay here. I'm not going to stay in the house. How about that? And it's okay, because I don't have to be here. So, and that was a really defining moment. But that the feeling of being held was never gone. The complication inside of the relationships were dicey at times and hurtful. A lot of pain, you know, but we've come a long way. We've come a long way. And, you know, we're in a real good spot. I mean, listen, I'm 46 years old. She ain't got no choice. I mean, it's not, the phase is long, Ma.
Not just passing through.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was not easy.
Oh man.
But that feeling, mm-hmm. that never went away.
So you always had your love with your
that spiritual
and dare I say Christian God through like underneath the occasional challenges of what Christianity was the people were saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was so interesting. It's like I heard what they would call the word.
Right.
But I felt like I got my word directly. Do you
yes.
know?
Yes.
I was like what you telling me?
Yeah.
and when I do the thing, when I pray, when I am chest exposed up to the heavens, God is saying, you're all right, girl. You're all right. And because I made you this way, I have things for you to do. You are meant to teach and show the world a thing. You're supposed to be in this body. You're supposed to be in, you know, you're supposed to walk the world the way that I made you. Go forth and do that thing. So I didn't have any, I always knew that I would be either a preacher, a teacher, or an actor. And I always knew that I was lesbian. Always. Like from the time I was in kindergarten, I said, I want me a lady.
Nice.
I had no words for what it was, but I was like, I think I want a wife. I think I want a girlfriend. Yeah. Just knew.
Someday. Just for funsies, if you're open to it,
yeah.
Via email, if you could send me your birth date, your birth time to the minute,
okay,
the city and state you were born, I have to see your human design chart. I have to see it. And okay. Then what I'll do is, if you give me the gift of that, I will record a little thing about your chart and send it back to you so that in case it's ever fun or useful for you to hear it.
Yeah.
But I have to see it. No. You are such a special person, and I feel like you've made me cry 6 different times.
Oh no.
Yes. Yes.
Listen, I want to tell you, like, Sophia is like inside of in my heart space is my best. And like what the conversation we're having now is like conversations she and I have in general. And so like having people who are open this way in your life, they keep you grounded. And it doesn't matter how long it's been since I've talked to her or whenever. It's like, we're here, we have a good laugh. First thing on the phone, we just crack up, and that we're just open and ready. But we feed each other that way. And it keeps you grounded in your spirituality. It keeps you grounded in knowing that you are in conference with God.
Yeah, and with people that are in some form of that same space. I mean, Sophia's becoming our sort of guest booker is its own, like, we didn't have a conversation with her. We didn't go like, you know, be good at this, Sophia. She literally came to us. She's a friend of both of ours, and she listens to the podcast, and she's just was like, almost like, I'm called to this. She says, I need to do this thing for y'all. And we also both went like, yep, like rather than that's weird or anything. So just having her, I mean, that's part of that kind of being in flow with the right people and the right folks.
Absolutely. And she's categorically the best.
So. this episode dedicated to Sophia, for sure. Okay, I sadly have to hop off, but I feel very lucky to have met you. And just thank you for being here, and I hope we can stay in touch. I feel like I could also talk to you for another 2 hours, so it'd be nice to have you back sometime if you're open to it.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Absolutely. I appreciate it. Enjoyed the conversation very much. So thank you. Thank you.
Super quick, do you have anything coming up that people should know about? That's always the good question. We're artists.
Everything is in development right now. So, you know, it's all on the website. Go to the what's happening or whatever. I don't know what the click on is that, but it's so busy, that website. But, you know, follow me, DonettaGrays.com, and you'll be in the know.
DonettaGrays.com, y'all. D-O-N-E, one N.
Two N's.
Two N's, two T's.
D-O-N-N-E-T-T-A.
Grays, plural.
Yeah. G-R-A-Y-S.
Yes.
Yes. .com. All right.
Do your work, everybody.
Thanks, Donetta.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks, Katie.
Take care. Love you guys.
Bye.
What are you asking for? All of the answers? Say what? All of the answers? Yeah, all the answers.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you. Please email us with your questions so that we have questions to answer in the Akashic Records. Our email address is allanswerspod@gmail.com. That's allanswerspod@gmail.com. And if you'd like to find us on Facebook or Twitter, it's @allanswerspod. Thank you.
Mixed and edited by Desmond McNeese for We Mixed It, LLC. Go to whatsoundsawesome.com.